whether it's what's going on in our own bedrooms, the decision to get married, the decision to have children, the decision concerning how many children, and so on and so forth. It's all details. It's all iterations of the same thing.
Welcome to From the Inside Out. I'm Rivka.
And I'm Ida.
We're mums, wives, entrepreneurs, and friends on a mission to change the world for the better, one conversation at a time.
Through interviews with world-renowned thinkers, leaders, and our everyday heroes, we bring you wisdom, insight, and practical tools that can change your life for the better. We believe that every experience provides us with an opportunity for learning. Our job is to be patient with the process of growth and trust that our journey will lead us to where we're meant to be.
Words can inspire us, but it's only once we channel that inspiration into action that we begin to experience the positive change we want to see in the world. We hope this platform will inspire you to create positive change in mind, body, and soul from the inside out.
Thank you for being here, and let the conversation begin.
We're really excited about today's sponsorships for the episode. We have two.
Today's episode is sponsored by Tevido. It's a website and it's an app that has hundreds of original and quality videos for Jewish kids, Jewish boys and girls. And it's specifically designed to be a safer and simpler place for Jewish kids' entertainment so that you can literally hand it to your child and be comforted knowing that there's no ads or no content that you might not want your kids to see.
What's different about Tevido is that new videos are added weekly and content is produced solely for the subscribers. We're talking 3D animation, live action film, and so much more. And coming in time for Hanukkah is a live action movie about Maccabees in the year 2022. I am actually really looking forward to sharing this with my kids. Tevido makes a great gift for the whole family for Hanukkah. Let your kids' superheroes be superhero from Tanakh. There is such a huge variety of content that they won't ever be bored. So Tevido is usually $99 a year, but you can use the code INSIDEOUT for 15% off on Tevido.com, TOVEEDO.com, and then use the code INSIDEOUT and you get 15% off. Use it all capital letters.
This is great.
Yeah, amazing. Another awesome sponsor that we have, which I feel very connected to because I actually have one of these. And coming up, I'm going to have two because I love it so much, is Yafi Begun Wigs, which is very appropriate for this episode because we do discuss hair covering within the episode. And the whole episode is about and the power of woman. So we have a co-sponsor, Yafi Begun, who has been manufacturing wigs and selling internationally for over 20 years. Yafi herself sources every strand of virgin, unprocessed, luxurious South American hair. Every wig made by Yafi is a piece of art. I really do believe so from the wig that I have. And if you want the best quality wig on the market at the best price, definitely, I agree, it's one of the best prices in getting a lace top wig. Yafi Begun has been the answer for me. Before we begin, we just want to read a latest review, which is always so meaningful. So thank you for sharing them. Please continue to share them. And also, if you would like to sponsor an episode, reach out to rivkaandida@gmail.com. It's been really special to have sponsors and it helps us to keep going.
And to spend more time on it, to grow this platform, you know, the sponsorships certainly make it a lot easier to contribute the time that we have to really creating quality content for you all. It's very time consuming, but I think it's holy work and it's important work. And we plan on continuing to bring this to you for a long time.
We love what we do. So thank you. Ida, do you want to read?
Okay, yeah, I'll read. Oh, this is a great one because it's about my mom. Okay. Thank you so much for the interview of Ida's mom. An example of an unsung hero. Anywhere we can see the poem written to our listener, Yael. First of all, thank you for the beautiful review. And yes, absolutely. I will get that poem and I will include it in the podcast notes.
I don't blame Yael for wanting the poem written out because that poem that your mother shared made me cry.
And she actually wrote it in Russian also.
Yeah, she said it in the episode. Anyway, I agree with you, Yael, that Ida's mom is an unsung hero. And I just met her in person at Ida's beautiful bat mitzvah for her daughter. And you feel it even more so in person, like everything. Yeah. But I'm so grateful that we were able to share her story. It's one of my favorites. I'm so inspired by her. Another episode that is also one of my favorites that someone just wrote, our latest review, the Tzvi Freeman interview. And this is from Mushka Matt. I absolutely love this interview. Your questions were so insightful and listening to him was so enlightening. I enjoy all of your interviews and thank you for all your hard work. Thank you so much, Mushka Matt, for sharing this. Yes, Tzvi Freeman was so enlightening and inspiring, and thank you for sharing. So please continue to share your reviews.
So this episode was very intriguing and different from anything we've done in the past. And Rivka, you had suggested that we bring on Rivka Slanim onto this platform in a conversation about holy intimacy. What inspired you to want to interview Rivka Slanim for this episode?
I've been wanting to interview Rivka for a while because she ended up being a color teacher for one of my daughters. A color teacher being somebody that spends time with the bride before they get married to explain to them the laws of family purity and to inspire them to bring family purity and holiness into their marriage. And my daughter was very inspired by Rivka Slanim. And I think that it's very important today to have women that inspire a generation to want to bring God into the marriage and to be inspired by Taharat HaMishpacha, going to the mikvah, because that is such a meaningful part of a relationship. And so I thought it'd be great to have her on our show. And I think it's divine providence that it's right after a marriage council that we just had a great discussion with to bring this element into the picture. And she also just came out with a book called Holy Intimacy. So the timing is right. And we have brought her co-author, Sara Marazov, on together with her. What did you think of the episode, Ida?
I thought it was important. The reason I think it's important is because our kids are curious. They're looking for information. So if we're not giving it to them, who are they getting it from? And many parents are uncomfortable talking to their kids about intimacy, the birds and the bees, whatever you want to call it, which makes sense. You know, we want to shelter our kids to some extent, but we also need to make sure that when we do have these conversations, that we're prepared for them. Like, what age do we start talking to our kids? How much do we disclose to them? Do you wait until you're engaged to start learning about Taharat HaMishpacha, or should you start a little bit sooner? So these are the questions that we're addressing in this episode. And I would say these are kind of like infrequently asked questions that we need to turn into frequently asked questions. And that's why we titled the episode Infrequently Asked Questions, but we're trying to change that.
Yeah.
So Rivka, thank you for I really appreciate that you had suggested her. I've seen her on many GEM videos. I think she leads the JLI retreats and the programming and the curriculum. Like, I've certainly heard her name a lot, and it was really a privilege to be able to speak to her and her co-author, Sara Marazov.
And I think that it's also important for us to hear about marriage from a Torah perspective. It's nice to hear it from that lens, especially from someone who's had a lot of experience in dealing with religious, not religious, and dealing with people from all women from all walks of life. That's why I love this episode. And I think it's an important conversation for all of us to hear.
I agree. Okay. Just a side note, my older sister, Sarah Lazar, she actually gives kala classes. She teaches brides the laws of Taharat HaMishpacha. And I'm totally plugging her because she's really good. And if anybody is looking for like a pre-marriage Taharat HaMishpacha teacher, I'll include the contact info in our podcast notes. Yeah.
She's an amazing, cool, bright, smart woman. So I have no doubt she'd be an amazing color teacher.
She is. I wholeheartedly agree. She's awesome.
So there you go. If you want to search for color teachers, you got two right here.
That's right.
Enjoy the episode.
You wrote a book together called Holy Intimacy, and essentially it was to address infrequently asked questions, and questions people probably had but were afraid to bring up or address relating to intimacy. Can you tell us the backstory, how you decided to write this book and why?
My husband and I have been on Shlichus in Binghamton, New York, primarily servicing a huge Jewish population at what was once SUNY Binghamton and is now called Binghamton University. And for years now, I've been teaching a Hilchot Nida class to my girls, at least for 30 years, in the belief that this information could be very important to them, not just when they get engaged, but in their journey as to decisions they're making about who they would date and who they might eventually marry, and just to understand this part of their legacy as Jewish women. I also, of course, counsel young people and get them ready for marriage. And I guess somewhere in Terelia in this journey, there were from among them also Chabad women who might hear me speak on the topic. Somewhere along this journey, I started speaking publicly on the topic of mikvah and then ultimately published a book. And I guess there was something about perhaps the openness or the honesty. And I found myself answering questions that were coming from a whole different demographic. And they started to sound awfully familiar to the questions I was getting from my demographic here in Binghamton.
As someone that likes to pursue truth, I felt a strong need to upgrade the way we teach Kallis.
But I will tell you one striking story that I have never forgotten, probably took place closer to 30 years ago than anything else. One of my cohorts included a girl I had never seen before. She had never come to Shabbos meal, none of our programming, and that was unusual. And she sat through, it's a series of 8 classes, and it's at least 90 minutes a class, so it's quite a commitment. And she sat through all the classes silently until we came to the unit on the behaviors of woman and husband during the time that she's in Nida and what halacha says about that. And at one point during the class, when I paused, she almost erupted. She said, "Now I finally understand." And this was a young woman whose grandparents had been in the former Soviet Union. And there was a story in their family of how this couple had slept for 10 years with children between them so they would not trespass the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, Hilchot Nida. And she never understood that. She never had context for that, but she had a sense that it had to have something to do with what she had seen advertised. So she came to take these classes to understand, because where her grandparents lived, they did not have the possibility to use a natural body of water, nor was it possible for this woman to travel by train or any other modality of transport. And she knew that this is what her grandparents had done for 10 years. I once had another young woman that came to the class, and that seemed a little bit more intuitive that she would be part of the cohort. But what she told me at the end took my breath away. She told me that her mother had been engaged to a young man. And the night before the wedding, he said something that made it clear to her that he was not going to keep the laws of Nida, which she had taken for granted they would keep. And when she heard that, she broke the engagement.
Oh, wow.
And this young woman told me that, you know, now Baruch Hashem, her parents have a wonderful marriage. Her mother clearly found another man. But she knew that this was something so important, she had to come to the class.
What came to mind when you were sharing the story about the couple that had the children in between and your student never understood why that was? Do you think it would have been better if she did understand? What do you think is the age appropriate? Because Sarah had also shared that we should talk to our children as early as we can. What is the age appropriate time to talk to our children?
I think these conversations should happen organically. I think parents need a lot of knowledge first, what would be age appropriate and how to respond in a matter-of-fact, natural way. It's an ongoing conversation in tidbits, and I drip over time. I do feel, though, that when a girl and a boy are reaching puberty or before, then they definitely should be taught by their parents. The scientific details about sexual relations, of course, factual manner and how Torah, maybe different words that Torah uses, because it needs to be presented in, you want your children to have the first presentation in the most holy, beautiful setting. Again, and they have to know who to come back to. Just as a teacher in high school, I may say that perhaps a lot of high school students may not want to ask their own parents about all kinds of things. And maybe they don't want to even tell their parents, disclose to their parents what they have been exposed to. And they feel more comfortable asking an outsider. I would think every high school, every junior high and high school needs to have a curriculum of what they teach in school and have somebody available or people available that if there are questions and why the beauty behind it, like besides answering factual questions sometimes that we need to understand, but giving them the range, if they have the ideas behind them, their choices are very different than if someone says, this is what we do.
Should a parent initiate the conversation if they're not getting the questions from their kids?
That's a very great question. And mikvah.org, about 4 years ago, we actually put together a 4-part series called Conversations with Our Children. We did interview psychologists, teachers, parents, rabbanim, and that was part of the presentation of when do we initiate, or the same question, like, do Tati and mommy sleep in the same bed together? How will we answer that for a 2-year-old, a 6-year-old? Like, we had different stages of development and we role modeled different answers. And we got a lot of positive feedback. Probably now I would upgrade it. This was like 4 years ago. It was definitely novel. It was just a must. The parents didn't have the tools. Now the conversation started. Parents talk to parents. Mothers talk to mothers. Hopefully fathers. We did a follow-up in this summer for fathers because the fathers needed a bit more prompting and information. How to say it. I still think there's a gap in school education. That's going to take a much bigger push to make a change.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's so important for people to learn, study, understand so that they can feel comfortable with this information and with their position so that when their child asks them a question, it doesn't throw them into a tizzy and it doesn't cast them into this state of disequilibrium, but that they're able to answer from a place of comfort and reassurance and truth. And in my case, because my children attended, at least for the first years of their education, our local Hebrew day school, I got these questions fast and furious and very early. And I realized that I just had to answer, first of all, honestly, because if a child doesn't know with every fiber of their being that they will get honesty from their parents, then who can they trust in this whole wide world? So that's number one. And number two, that I had to, before this was even a thing, you know, binary or hold two truths at the same time. That's really what Hasidus is all about. It's always about two truths coming from Atzmos, from something transcendent. And I have to teach my children that, yes, what you heard in school is true. I know it sounds very bizarre, but when you're older, you'll understand just how beautiful and how holy this is. But I never wanted to tell them it wasn't true, because they would, it's just kicking the can down the road. They'll find out in camp. They'll find out, and they'll find out, I am sure, from a much more unsavory source. So everybody, like Sarah said earlier, has their own experience and it'll happen at different ages, and children are all different. But we need to be comfortable so we can be prepared when they come to us. Because if they see that it causes us to become flustered and uncomfortable and to try to change the subject, that becomes very dangerous when we obfuscate and they, and we force them to go to other sources that are just unsavory at best.
It's part of the discussion, that Conversations with Our Children series.
Is that available as a resource?
It's a podcast, on podcast, mikvah.org/, it's on Spotify, it's on our mikvah.org/audio.
Okay, that's so great to know.
We'll include that in podcast. We can put that in our podcast notes, because then everyone can listen to the class on how to address our children.
Okay, but following that, like Rivki said, a lot of parents were missing the real information. So then we had a series called Divinity in Our Marriage, and it's the first time we actually put on podcast all about intimacy, mm-hmm, from the Kedusha perspective, from different speakers. There was also, I did one on explaining gender relationships. You know, what do I tell my child? Like, why can I talk to boys? Why can't I hug them? Both from the halacha perspective and also some practical Torah tools. There was also very well received. Like Rivki said, if we are comfortable with the information, we could give it over to our children in a candid, matter-of-fact, comfortable way. They do sense our discomfort. I do have this feedback from the girls. My motivation for this book actually was my biggest gift to my students. And when I told them that it was released, I got a standing ovation. because they feel the need more than anyone else. They know what's going on out there. They feel the gap. And today I just came from school and I had so much positive feedback from the seminary students. They need the real information.
By acknowledging that it's normal to talk about intimacy, you're validating feelings that they're not going to share unless they know that it's okay to. And that's why I think that you doing this is extremely important because of your credibility and knowledge of Yiddishkeit. And so hearing that is comforting, I'm sure.
When our children do share something with us that they heard in school or that they watched or whatever it may be, to share with them, one day you're going to see how holy this experience is. I think that is really a very special thing to say to a child. This can be a holy experience. I think that's really nice. Thank you. We actually want to answer. We want some of these specific questions to be answered today so that we and our listeners have the knowledge to be able to pass on some of these ideas to our children. Can we start with, you know, get straight to it? Everyone today, people like freedom is on our minds. Peace, freedom is on today's generation's minds. And some of today's generation is struggling with the observance of Torah laws and some of these, you know, nida and some of these customs because they feel like it's the opposite of freedom. So how do you define freedom? In your words, because maybe the definition of freedom is different for everybody. And for someone who does believe that the laws of Judaism are too confining, what would you say to them? How would you approach this?
Well, I would ask them to tell me what they would do if they overheard the following conversation. The conversation takes place in a drug rehabilitation center. And the doctor stops by one of the client's rooms and says, "Such a shame, you were doing so well. Unfortunately, your urinalysis this morning shows that you've been doing again, that you did a line of cocaine or something. It's such a shame that you can't get control over yourself." And the client looks back at the doctor and says, "Huh. You're one to talk. Look at you. You're here every day, all night. You're a workaholic. You're no better than me. You just have a different drug." And I would ask this young person who wants to be free, who wants to cast off, you know, whatever restrictions or things they perceive as being restrictions in their life, to say, "Well, what do they think about this conversation? You know, is in fact the doctor as, let's use the term, sick as the client in the rehabilitation center?" And I think most people, when they're faced with this question, they kind of recoil and they're like, "Well, obviously it's two different things." But when you press them, what is the difference? Almost everybody will say, because working, while there can be an off-kilter work-home balance, that is for sure. And while work can become an addiction, but it is essentially a productive, positive, you could even say essential aspect of what it means to be human, to contribute, to make a difference, to work. While you can't say the same about putting dangerous substances into your body. So in our book, we use the Rebbe's words, as we do very often throughout the book. In the Rebbe's words, what is freedom? Freedom is acting on your essence. It's a very different definition of freedom. It goes way beyond freedom being, you know, the positive freedom to do what you want, or what's called negative freedom, to be freed from certain restrictions. It goes way beyond that. And the Rebbe zeroes in on freedom being the ability to express your essence, which is why freedom for a plant is different from freedom for a stone. Freedom for a stone means leaving it be. For a plant, it needs to grow. So it actually needs to be tethered to the ground. It needs to have water. It needs to have nutrients. And some plants need sun. But for the animal, freedom is nothing like that. It needs to be free to roam, to protect itself and its young, find food and shelter and so on and so forth. And then for a human being, has all of those basic metabolic animal needs, plus the need for a higher consciousness, for a self-construal, to be enmeshed in something productive. Those are human needs. And so when people look at these things as restrictions, for me, you know, I'm like those real estate people. You ask them what's the most important thing. They say location, location, location. For me, it's education, education, education. I think when people can't see the beauty, it's most likely because they have suffered exposure of these ideas in a less than holistic, healthy, deep presentation. And I think that the ideas of Hasidus especially are the elixir for this generation. They are literally the magic potion to take us through these dark and turbulent times of Golos. That's what we hope to share.
That is just beautiful. I love everything you shared here. It's really about activating your higher power. That's the way you're saying is freedom.
We're not saying this.
This is
a very famous letter by the Rebbe that explains what is freedom. But you know what? Everybody really knows this in their gut, because would you call the daily regimen of somebody who's training for the Olympics free? No. I mean, every calorie they take in is measured, and every moment of their day is slated. But it's for a certain purpose, and they don't chafe against it. You know, you could look at a string on the table and say it's free, but if it was only tied tautly into the violin, it could make beautiful music.
That's a beautiful analogy.
You know, we need to appreciate what it is we have, and we need to stop looking at halacha for a way out and realize halacha is our way in. It's our way into who we are and what we're doing in this world.
Well, because it's easy to look at boundaries as the opposite of freedom. I think as you were talking about the definition of freedom, the way the Rebbe puts it, and that's the truth, is happiness as well. Like, we can look at happiness as a superficial, instant gratification, whereas true happiness is really about making your life meaningful. So I guess, you know, freedom is similar. It can seem like initially freedom is, you know, just enjoying the sunshine and not having to work on yourself. And that is free. Whereas really it takes work to tap into our essence.
Rifki has one demographic that she educates. And I have a slightly different one. Obviously, I come, you know, typical Crown Heights girls or Beis Rivka girls, they come to learn. And these concepts are equally fascinating for both. Like, when we started going through the questions that the girls have and how would you answer them, what struck us both was, wow, like, it's the same answer. Chassidus really is really what talks to the universal spectrum of the people that we meet. And it was just very interesting to note that how the way we address the questions through the lens of Chassidus resonated with so many women from so many different walks of life.
For someone who gets married and they have a lot going on, they want to, let's say, nurture the relationship before they start having children. I feel like we see a lot of that. So I'm just wondering what your view is on this whole idea that people are waiting a little bit longer, wanting to kind of get their act together to start a family.
You actually share a lot about this in your book, and we wanted you to share this perspective here. Yeah.
Or people who are at their limit and maybe have a few kids and are worried about having more.
I think Rifki gave a very nice muscle in our introduction, you know, about that twin tension, like the twins that are sharing the space. I think, first of all, we have to validate that part of our human existence is. And this is the same thread. It doesn't matter if you're new, just getting married, you're afraid to start a family right away, you have X amount of children for X amount of years, you have financial worries. Right. The equation really is the same, that we definitely have to validate that Hashem, and this is, I think, a theme throughout our book, which is how to bridge the tension of the two poles of the Gashmias, the physicality, and that part of our life, and the Eibishter, the holiness, the transcendent part of our life, and how to mesh the two and move forward in a healthy way. So it really comes out in every single conversation. But here as well, of course, we want to lay down the foundation of a healthy relationship. I mean, especially now we know so much about unhealthy relationships and maybe the divorce rate is higher. And there's so many logical reasons why we would want to do that as part of our entering marriage. It almost seems like the responsible thing to do, or maybe irresponsible to introduce a pregnancy when you're barely setting up your own relationship in a, you know, that first year of marriage. So let's acknowledge that, yes, one voice will talk like that. And we need to listen and validate that voice. We can't dismiss it. I think part of the beauty of the Chassidus of today is not to ignore and push away those voices, but actually listen to them and then listen to the other side of the story. Like the Rebbe says a few times, when the Rebbe talks about the topic of having the blessing of having children, is to tune in. What does your neshama say? So the same God that gave us the mitzvah of getting married that applies at the same time the mitzvah of pruvu of having children apply, of course the Eibishter wants us to have shalom bias. It's the same Eibishter. Again, who gave us this mitzvah in the first place? Would the Eibishter give us a mitzvah that contradicts to shalom bias? Does it have to be a contradiction? Or would the, in fact, Shana Rishayna, there's two mitzvahs, and Asay and Alaysa say, they talk about that the first year of marriage, husband and wife, right, are commanded to spend time, get to know each other, gladden each other's hearts. There could be a war going on, and communal affairs are set aside because this is the year that you really have to work on your relationship. So if the same Eibishter gave you that gift, that command, there can't be a contradiction. Yes, we have to reconcile and we have to work at it. So again, putting the Eibishter back in the picture really shifts the way we think about it. Now, there will be people that suffer trauma or whatever. There could be some reasons of anxiety, something extra that, yes, the same Torah that says have children is the same Torah that says if it affects your health, you know, there's another mitzvah, which means to guard your health. So, of course, there will always be a certain percentage of people that Torah will say, first, you have to take care of your mental health, emotional health, and introduce the pregnancy a little later. Riff, do you want to add?
I think I want to zoom out and just point to our title, which I think kind of encapsulates what we try to do with this book. Because you could say, well, what's the difference between intimacy and holy intimacy? So I think we would say that if you understand intimacy to be a gem, what we hope the book can be is a setting for that gem. And what the setting does is allow for the gem in all of its beauty, its cuts, its colors to manifest. So what we're putting forth in this book is a lot of different aspects that all kind of interface with holy intimacy, which is intimacy that's tethered in something larger than the self. It's not circumscribed by our desires and our yin, but is embedded in something larger. And whether it's what's going on in our own bedrooms, whether it's the decision to get married, the decision to have children, the decision concerning how many children and so on and so forth. First and foremost, it's embedded in something transcendent. And everything else really is commentary. It's all details. It's all iterations of the same thing. And the postmodern age is really all about the self. So this can be a very abrasive notion that it's not just about yourself. That it's first and foremost the fulfillment of something much larger. So having children, for instance, from the perspective of Torah, is a commandment rather than a lifestyle choice. Marriage is a commandment rather than a lifestyle choice. And then everything kind of flows from that setting. On the other hand, I just want to add that what we do is kind of zigzag between these deep, important ideas and the nitty-gritty of daily life. And by presenting these deep ideas, we don't mean for them to become something with which you obfuscate the problems that are very real. That is not the intention. The intention is to create a framework, again, to create a setting. And at the same time, life can get messy. And we did not shy away from talking about various aspects of that messiness. Something that might grate on the nerves of, I think, some of our readers might be the many times we counsel people to speak with a mashpia. And again, set against a postmodern reality, a sociological reality, that sounds ridiculous. Like, these are your issues, it's personal, and just do whatever you want. But what we're trying to say, in part, certainly, is people don't find it ridiculous to consult with a financial expert or to get a coach in many areas of their life or hire somebody to help them work out properly in the gym. All of this sounds eminently logical. But to consult with somebody who can help you in the most important decisions you're going to make in your life somehow seems to evade logic. And again, this is not our counsel. This is not our advice. The Rebbe over and over and over said, "Aseh lecha rav," and explained that "Aseh lecha rav," make for yourself a rav, means a mashpia, somebody who knows you, somebody who can get down in the trenches with you, somebody who you could be honest with and can help you navigate.
Well, I want to make it practical for a moment, if you don't mind me just being straightforward. Like, let's say I'm a newly married woman, which I'm not. I'm married for 27 years, but I'm just like putting myself on someone else's show. Yes, thank God. But I, let's say I'm a newly married woman and, you know, I still, my marriage isn't like 100% where I want it to be. So I want to work on my relationship and get it in the right place. And I also want my husband to be financially stable and, you know, I am scared of calling a mashpia because I'm not ready to have a baby yet because I think that we need to make more money. And I also feel that our relationship could be an even better place than it is, even though it's okay. So I want to wait for all that and then have a baby. Now, I just want to tell you about calling a mashpia. I might not want to call a mashpia because I don't really want to know the answer. I'd rather just not have a baby yet. But let's say I do decide to call a mashpia because I really do want to know what I should do in that kind of situation. What would you tell a young woman?
So you're asking your mashpia to validate the choice that you made.
Yes. And also asking, well, yes, that's what I'm saying. If I asked her opinion, she'll probably go and tell me. I don't know. But yes, I don't know if I'm asking for validation or your opinion.
So, I don't know, Rifki, if you want to, it depends who this person is. Mm-hmm. But I would take the conversation. What is it you want to hear from me? Do you want to, if you're asking me, it means she's not 100% sure of her and her husband's choice. By the way, it's joint. It's not, I don't know if it's her or him or both of them together. If there wasn't a question, she wouldn't ask. The fact that she's toying with it, which direction does she want to go? Should we discuss both directions? Let's say you want to make yourself more ready to let the Abishter in the picture. And should we go in that direction? Like, you want to help her discover that in that. What's that inner tension and which direction she wants to go? I don't think the mashpia is coming top down. I would continue the conversation and say, okay, so should we take it in both directions and see where it takes us? And then we'll revisit the question.
So you're saying you would revisit the question from the perspective where you have the senior partner in the picture?
She has to have the senior partner in the picture as well, if she wants to. But if she's already calling, it means she wants more of that senior partner conversation. Otherwise, right. Why would we call in the first place?
Right, that's true.
But we could only take it as far as she's ready, mm-hmm. and maybe a notch higher before she runs in the other direction. So it's not a top-down conversation. I think it's meeting someone in their space and helping them broaden their perspective, that they come to their own conclusion putting the ABA student equation that much more expanded based on that particular, you know, situation. That's my opinion, but Rifki, you could add.
Yeah, I don't have a position on this that's contrary to what Sara said, but I would add that if somebody is calling me, they have to know who I am. They have to have a reason for having called me. And so if they are calling me, I owe it to them to share some truths, whether they reject or embrace them is entirely their option. But I would talk to them about things like the fact, the truth, at least the truth as I see it, that barring true dysfunction or true pathology due to trauma that needs to be taken care of and so on and so forth. But if you're talking about pedestrian doubts about if our relationship is at a level where we've bonded enough or not, nothing will help a couple bond like having a child. Nothing. And young people need to hear this from older people who've been there and done that and are speaking from life experience. They need to hear this radical heresy that it's okay to struggle with less funds because some things are even more valuable than money. Shocker. They need to be reminded that imagine how beautiful it is to dance at the wedding of your great-grandchild. So I think that we owe it to younger women and men to help them broaden, deepen, elongate their perspective, because it's so easy to suffer from myopia. You know, all you have to do is just put your, if you just put your pinky in front of your eye, you can block out the whole world with just your pinky. And that's one of the things we try to do in this book. We talk about how much the Rebbe loved us, how he tried to lift us up and give us a larger perspective, give us a longer view, give us a deeper perception. Because left to our own devices, we could thwart the greatest gifts that are coming our way. Not because we want to, but because we are unconsciously enmeshed in a society that's giving us values that are dichotomously, that are just dichotomous to what Torah and mitzvahs is all about.
I would add that even people, you know, if someone, let's say, does want to wait to make more money to have kids, there's no guarantee that they're going to make enough money to have kids. So it's like kicking the can down the road again.
Well, I could talk for an hour about this. I don't know how to put it in a nutshell. I guess open the book and read it. But I was one of those lucky people that actually heard the Rebbe talking about the message of the beauty of having a big family. Although I lived in Montreal, but we listened to Rebbe's voice. And my mother was actually the one having those children. Like, Baruch Hashem, I'm one of 12 children. So my mother was having those babies. And every time she heard the Rebbe talk, like, she would walk out beaming. Like, if she had, like, lapel pins, you know, first star general, second star. But for me, I wasn't having the babies. I listened, but I didn't really know how much of it really entered my heart. And when I had my second baby in the Jewish General Hospital in Montreal, I was very petite and my husband looked very young in those days. And this nurse was like poking fun. Was this a planned pregnancy? Like, holds the first one, how's the second? Was this a planned pregnancy? Like, what popped out of my mouth was, yes, it was. It was planned by God. I made her write it down on her notes. Like, planned by God in the middle of labor.
How old were you?
21.
That's pretty young.
And I realized... And I realized that the Rebbe's words really, like, it was the truth. It just popped out. And I remember how she, like, melted in 5 seconds. Like, she didn't realize, like, who she was talking to. And I was also shocked. I guess when you're in labor, all kinds of crazy stuff could come out of your mouth. And then fast forward many years later, and I'll try to make this fast. It was a hectic shot this morning. And I was really cranky. And my baby was colicky, and my kids came home fighting, and don't ask. And I was mad because my husband came home late. And then we had a guest who popped in, a bacher, you know. And he looks around, he surveys the scene, and he says, look at this. This is insane. He was going to be married soon. He goes, we decided we're having one or two babies. That's it. Like, this is crazy. And I of course, I was hurt because he, you know, I felt quite dysfunctional at the moment. But then I was like, why don't I have something popping out of my mouth? Like, I heard those Rebbe Sichas and they're so beautiful. Like, where are my words? I felt like so stuck. And then one of my children said, like, you're talking like this because you don't even have one baby. I promise you, you're going to have one. You're going to want double the amount sitting around this table. Now, he was flabbergasted. Very quickly, my husband made kiddush and everyone was fine. And we, you know, it was a cranky morning. Okay. But I made it my business to research those sichas all over again. So I'll have what to say. That little flicker of a doubt, like, maybe I'm crazy. Like, why am I bringing these? It's a dysfunctional family. Kids are crying. Wife is cranky. Like, this is not right. It's supposed to be perfect and wonderful and happy and smiley. This is like not life. And so I had my journey all over again. And I realized that when I repeated them to other people, like straight from the source, it was very refreshing because we do have to constantly realign ourselves with the emes. And my journey continued. When I started doubting myself, maybe Hashem must have given me, like, I'm not sure if the Ebershter did right. Like, you know, I have to learn again. We have to keep bringing the Ebershter back in our lives, real time. We live in a world that draws us in the other direction. It's all about self and self-care and self-this and self-that. But our true self is the Ebershter, and our true self-care. We need self-care in all layers. We have to take care of our emotions. We have to take care of our bodies. We have to take care of our thought processes. But we really have to nurture our neshama. A lot more things fall into place.
And part of truth is feeling doubt and having those moments, because that's life. You know, it's the truth of life. There's no perfection in raising a family. Every mother goes through, you know, the ebbs and flows. So, that's really part of the MS. All the experience.
Yeah, you know, the amount of time we're spending on the particular topic of the, you almost think the whole book is about having children, but I guess we're using it as an example because of. Yeah. How the same themes flow over and over again. Yeah. So we use it as a more practical example, but that's really only one chapter.
Right. And I just want to bring up something else, another example, if you can share, because you said you often had to go straight to the source to remind you of what counts most and what focus you want to have and the way you want to think in your life. Today, it's if you can inspire our listeners and share with us, or for those who are having a hard time covering their hair, how you would approach somebody who is having a hard time covering their hair or is going through a stage where they're questioning if they should cover their hair or should not cover their hair. What would you say to them? What have you read from the Rebbe's words, or what has inspired you wearing a shetel?
Rifki?
I would begin with tracing the trajectory of this mitzvah from the Torah, from the Pasuk, going through the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the Rishonim and the Acharonim. And first, people have to be disabused of this notion that a woman covering her hair is some kind of a chumrah, some kind of stringency, some kind of negotiable aspect. First, need to know that it's a mitzvah midaraisa. That's number one. Now, as to exactly how carefully it should be.
Can you just translate what mitzvah, what?
That is a biblical commandment. It's firmly rooted in the Torah. It's not a negotiable aspect of halacha. Notwithstanding the fact that it's true that there were, for some generations, observant women or women observant in other areas of their life who did not cover their hair. There's a lot to say about that, but it doesn't change the fact, okay? So we know that this is a kind of a weak link, because you see couples where the husband wears a yarmulke, which originally, until the Middle Ages, was only for men who were the Shluchei Tzibor that led the services. They read from the Torah. Then it was codified in halacha. So we're going to put in the category of mitzvah d'rabbanan, a rabbinic commandment, which doesn't mean that it's unimportant, God forbid. But it's kind of jarring when you see a couple where he's wearing a kippah and she doesn't have anything on her hair. And I think it has a lot to do with just, again, a lack of education. It takes me back to my education. Now, when you add in the Zoharic factors, Jewish mysticism, and then when you add in the teachings from Rebbe on this subject, and you see the passion in the letters and in the oral testimony of individual conversations that Rebbe had with couples, with people, you literally see how the Rebbe wanted to pour blessing into our lives. And I think that that's a very important thing for people to see for themselves, to read. These are transcriptions. These are literally word for word. And who in their right mind does not want to bring blessing into their lives? And at one point, the Rebbe says, you know, I understand. You might be thinking to yourself, you don't have to be like Kimchis, the woman described in the Talmud and the Gemara that she covered her hair so fastidiously that the walls of her house never saw her hair. Maybe you're thinking, it's fine. I just want to have regular children. I don't need to have children who are Kohanim Gedolim. But Rebbe says, but this flies in the face of the nature of every mother who doesn't want to give her child every advantage, every leg up. Who is not going to try their hardest to give every positive medium to their child in life? And I think that another way of saying what we've been saying is we need to be more attentive to spiritual reality. You know, for instance, now it's all the rage. Everybody's allergic to something. Everybody has a sensitivity. Everybody's on a special diet. If we would only remember that we're not bodies that happen to have souls, we're souls that have to be encased in bodies because that's how God created this world. And our soul literally has allergy to certain things. Our soul can go into anaphylactic shock. And the fact that we don't see that and have to call 911 doesn't negate that reality.
I just want to add a point. I think the fact that there's so much emotional sensitivity brings us a step closer to spiritual sensitivity. There's so much now about neurodivergent children or different modes of learning and anxiety and different, all these, the emotional, the psychological health became so big. I think it's a step closer for people to realize what Rifki said in such a good mashal about that soul. The soul has sensitivities. It's like one step closer. These mashalim, this mashal really resonates with people because it's more real nowadays than ever before. Sorry for that interruption, but I just
No, that's great. So I think that it's a gift. It's a gift to be able to be reminded of this truth, and then to say to ourselves, maybe it is an inconvenience to wear a cover on our hair. Maybe I really do miss the way the wind used to blow through my hair or feeling the sun on my scalp. Maybe my shaitel does give me a headache. And maybe I need to find a more comfortable shaitel, et cetera, or make some other accommodation or adjustment. But if I think about what this can do for me, for my husband, for my children, for my grandchildren, for my great-grandchildren, like we're always engaged in pros and cons, right? We're always engaged in making decisions. And here it just is so overwhelmingly weighed in one side. I think we just don't put enough time into thinking about what it is we're talking about, such a powerful conduit for blessing. Why would we want to shut that off?
Even though this is a Kabbalist all, you know, issue and it's Midai Raisa, it's like, it's a biblical commandment. Sometimes I think being able to explain in a rational way how it makes sense can help, even though that's not like the be all and end all. There's a recent psychological concept called the passion action formula. A lot of people feel like they don't have any passions and they're trying to tap into like a passion for, you know, for their career or their education, and they're stuck. And so a lot, there are motivational gurus who will say, reverse the formula. Don't wait for passion to, you know, adopt an action. Start with an action and then the passion will come. I feel like with something like covering my hair or some of the mitzvahs that are not as easy for people to do, perhaps that can be like another way to understand it. Yes, it could be hard, but sometimes the excitement and passion comes later than you expected.
I love what you just said. And it's worth noting that the Sefer HaChinuch says exactly this such a long time ago, that our feelings follow our actions. And some people might misunderstand this. They might think we're saying fake it till you make it. We're saying the opposite. This is who you are. You're not faking it. You're uncovering who you really are. The other stuff is extraneous to who you are. It's an overlay. Over and over, the Rebbe used, he would return to this theme again and again and again, that in his laws regarding divorce, the Rambam says that if there's a recalcitrant husband, just bring him into Beis Din and beat him up. And the Rambam preempts the question of the person learning these halachas, because everybody knows something about Jewish divorce, knows that the get has to be administered of the free volition of the husband. And the Rambam writes as much. So how can he say a few halachas later, beat him? So the Rambam answers, because when you beat him, you're not taking away his choice. You are freeing him from the forces that are impeding his truthful choice. He's a Jewish man and he wants to do the right thing. Now, this is not about beating anyone up, but it's about giving them information and tools and perspective and setting so that they can have the permission to move beyond the self to something higher, to something larger, to something transcendent, and allow that into their life. And like you said, see what might occur.
I do want to make reference that twice you mentioned about Kabbalah's oil. I want to emphasize the Kabbalah part, to be receptive. I think our job is to give people the education and the information that they could receive, that we should be receptive and open to try. And I think then the oil then doesn't become, chas v'shalom, a negative burden, but it becomes like a heavy crown, so to speak.
That's really nice. Beautiful.
I did want to address a question you had, which is what inspired us to release Holy Intimacy and who is the book ideally for?
Yes, please share.
And you know, we're both a similar age. We're both born in the 60s. So in the movie industry history, the 1960s marks the first time that a man and woman were seen in one bed on TV.
Okay. Good to know.
Just so we remember just how radically and how quickly things have lurched. And to me, that just encapsulates everything. We cannot live in denial that we are living in a different world, that our children are living in a different world, that it is incumbent upon us to take the truth and the beauty and unparalleled, valuable holiness, the gems that we have, and present them in a way that is necessary for a world in which everything has become so open. And at the very beginning of our book, and I'm just going to quote a few lines from this, we bring two extractions from the Rebbe. In 1968, during a Fabringa, the Rebbe said, "Is this modest conduct, you might ask? Can one talk publicly about such things, in brackets, intimacy, The Rebbe says, today, intimate subjects are written about openly in the newspapers and are being taught to 10-year-old children in school. And I'm just skipping a little bit. And the Rebbe says, the listeners will know more than the teachers, he's saying to rabbis, but the listener's knowledge will not have come from a holy source. So teach Taras HaMishpacha, don't be embarrassed. You will not reveal any secrets that your listeners do not know. Speak openly.
Yeah, I have read that in your book, and I had never, ever seen that before, and I found that so enlightening.
So that's what propelled us. We are not coming from a place where we want to cause waves. We want to engage in something, of shock value. We want to try to address the gap or the breach, not chalila create one. But the first thing that has to be done is to make it available, because the only things that grow successfully in darkness are fungi and mold. That's about it.
I want to add a very important detail. We spent a lot of time on those footnotes. I don't know if you noticed, hundreds of footnotes. Everything is sourced. So anybody who wants to delve more into that particular subject, everything is sourced so that everybody could track or trace where this came from.
That's a sign of a good writer. We interviewed Joseph Chilushkin, who wrote the book, The Rebbe, and he was saying that part of why it took him so long to write the book is because he wanted people to be able to have the resources to be able to say, oh, this story is true. And I think that's important, like to know where your words are coming from.
Yeah, and even the interviews that we had, we made sure that the people we interviewed, that everything was written down correctly, word for word. We had some interviews there.
Nice. Before we wrap up, we wanted to ask you if you can share. We like sharing like some practical tools and tips. If you can give us your top tips that come to mind for greater intimacy.
So first of all, communication. Sometimes women think my husband should know. Allowing and making yourself vulnerable, both of you, making that safe space where you can communicate each other's needs, wants, wishes, dreams, and sometimes quirks. Just that openness is so important. That's really true intimacy, is about making yourself vulnerable and feeling safe to share the real you. And you have to make time right away from the beginning of the marriage. It should be like a set conversation. How's it going? What can we do to improve? Because intimacy does evolve over time, which is the second tip. It's not like, it's not a formula of a math. 1 + 1 = 2. There's so many other factors that play into the vibrancy or even the practicality, a frequency of style. And as we grow, our marriage grows and depending on the environment, hormonal factors, and what we stress is in life, our intimacy will change. And if we value it for what it is, we make sure that as our life evolves, to make sure that our intimacies evolve accordingly, and understanding that. Those are two tips, communication and making time for that.
Simple tips that we need to actually implement.
I'd say the busier we are, the more we should value our intimacy, the vibes that come from the bedroom throughout the home are real, and everybody in the house can feel it. And that's why it's so important.
Yeah, there's a marriage therapist that we interviewed who said that an issue with intimacy is also an issue in the kitchen, and is also an issue in the living room. It's it's bigger than just the bedroom.
When we had one room houses, it was clear. The bedroom was the kitchen, it was everything. Now that everything's different compartments, people think that, the bedroom stands different. But the reality is, as you say, it definitely is all interconnected.
And like you say about time and priorities, you can say, I don't have enough time. But if it's a priority, if you want it to happen, it will happen no matter how much time there is. Rivki, do you have a couple of tips, quick tips you want to share?
Sarah gave us many more than two tips, if you were listening carefully.
Yes.
More like 22. and I concur with everything she said. But I want to push back on kind of this into details, and I want us to zoom out, and I want to use a story that my paternal grandfather would often cite about a son-in-law who did not like his mother-in-law very much, but once felt compelled to buy her a gift. So he went to the store, and he started to daydream because he saw all these gorgeous things that he might buy for somebody he actually cared for. And inadvertently, he knocked over a very expensive vase. And now he was beside himself, because not only does he have to buy this woman, he doesn't like a gift. Now he has to pay for this expensive gift. And then all of a sudden, he had a stroke of genius. He picked up all the pieces. He brought them to the front of the store. And he said, "Can you please wrap this up for me?" And in his mind, he conjured up a scenario where he was going to approach his mother-in-law, make all the right advances. And then he would slip on the proverbial banana peel, and he would profess his upset with perhaps this very, very fragile gift has been broken. And of course, she'll say it's the thought that matters. And it was going to be a perfect scenario. So as they're wrapping up the gift, he again begins to look at gifts he might buy for somebody he cared for. And then they snap him out of his reverie and they tell him that his gift is ready. And he brings this gorgeously wrapped gift to his mother-in-law. And she is surprised and very, very happy. And she begins to open up the box. And to both of their horror, every piece of the vase was separately wrapped in tissue paper. And I think we do this a lot. We take something in life, like intimacy, and we try to cut it to fragments. And we think that by doing this, we'll have more success. And what we're trying to do in this book is bring it all back in one whole. So holy intimacy is not blowing in the wind by itself. It's part of a larger thing called marriage. And it does interface with having children. And it does interface with kisui reish, with covering the head. And it does interface with the laws of taras mishpacha, and so on and so forth. And we have to treat it as the wholeness that it is. More practically, I would also add, you know, when you think about it, we learn over and over that intimacy between a husband and wife, of course, who, you know, had kiddushin in the right time, in the right way, is the holiest thing that a human being can engage in. And yet, remarkably, there's no bracha to be said before you're intimate. For everything, there's a bracha, not for this. And maybe, just maybe, I don't have a source for this, but maybe the lesson is that the bracha that the Masada Kiddushin makes under the chuppah is the bracha for all the intimacies. But then we have a new problem. You're not allowed to talk between when you make the bracha and you do the act. How can there be these interruptions? Maybe what we're being taught is that there is no interruption. There is nothing happening in your life that's not part of your intimacy. Everything has to feed this larger rubric, and we have to stop treating it as fragments. So yes, what you're doing in the kitchen, what you're doing in the den, what you're doing in the library, what you're doing in the car is part of your intimacy. Intimacy takes many, many forms, and these different parts feed each other in a synergy, in an intersectionality. And we can't forget that for one moment.
Very much enjoyed this conversation. So thank you for your time.
For the opportunity.
Yeah. And so we usually like to end with a favorite quote or something, a little message that resonates with you that we can sort of a parting message for our listeners. Is there something that comes to mind?
You know, I think we both have a favorite quote. So I'm going to let Sarah read it.
And I'll let Rifki elaborate.
I think it speaks for itself. But, you know, there's a reason we were able to do this project together. I mean, we're very, very different birds. We really are. But we share an enormous amount, and we both absolutely are infatuated with what Sarah is going to read now. It's from the Hayom Yom.
And not only is it from Hayom Yom, but it's the Hayom Yom of Chaf Beishvat, which is the yahrzeit of the Rebbetzin Chaim Moshka. And we felt like we want to include this. And this is really a big theme. And the reason why it's my favorite quote, it also resonates with all my students. And that is, it's a quote from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, right? That's how you name. And it says there are two kinds of laws, laws that generate life and laws that are generated by life. Man-made laws result from life. That is why they differ in every country, each according to its local circumstances. God's Torah is the divine law that generates life. It is the Torah of truth, the same in all places and all times. The Torah is eternal. And that is, okay, that, end quote. But that is such a secure, that is like the rock, the security. That's the bottom line. And it actually is very liberating.
Wow.
Rifki, did you want to add to that? And thank you for that.
No, those words are too beautiful to pile on. But I do want to say that we recognize that our book is a book to grow with, meaning that there are things that might hit a young woman at a certain time in her life as like, what are they talking about? So we ask our readers to know that there's a lot of experiences, if they're young, that they haven't yet encountered, and that it's a book to come back to and to grow with. And we very much hope that people will accept this in the spirit that we are presenting it, which is really Dvarim Hayetzim and Halev. It's really a conversation. This is not a book of halacha. This is not a book of hashgafa even. It's a conversation. Maybe it's even a hug or an embrace.
I'll tell you what's really inspiring that I'm thinking right now, that two women born in the 1960s went and wrote a book on holy intimacy, which is something very delicate for people to discuss today in today's generation. And yet you really took the truth.
Living with the times.
And you brought it to us today. And I just want to thank you for that.
You had a window into something that most people didn't know. What people thought were like infrequently asked questions were actually frequently asked questions. So we need to move to that. That space, and I think that's what you did for us. So that's really beautiful, and it's MS, and we want to thank you so much. Really, really, thank you.
Thank you, for your time, and good luck.
Thank you,
Yeah, it's amazing what you do. Also, that you have to grab opportunities to teach women out there to have healthier, happier, fulfilling Yiddish lives. It's amazing.
The women of the 70s and 80s coming now to. We're like bridging, you know, trying to bridge the gap too a little bit.
Well, my personal goal is not to get old, never to grow up.
It's a personal goal too, so, you know. Okay, on that note, forever young, with holy intimacy, thank you. Thank you on behalf of us and our listeners.
You're welcome.